In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Michael Leader.
I'm David Jenkins.
I'm Hannah Strong.
I'm Sophie Monks Kaufman.
And on the show this week, we have one final film to discuss before the end of the year, Julia Ducournau's Titane. And then we're diving into Little White Lies' picks for the best films of 2021. All coming up on Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Yes, welcome back, listeners. Oh, we have three contributors on the podcast this week. Sophie, it's always a pleasure. Welcome back. How have you been?
I've been all over the shop. High highs, low lows, such is life.
Well, hopefully this isn't one of those highs being on the podcast with
us. I mean, all these little faces, very cute.
David, how are things going at Little White Lies HQ towards the end of the year?
Yeah, hectic. Final big push before we can all go and have a sweet sherry. But looking forward to be able to clock off and hoping that I maybe avoid the Rona. few little things there to consider.
Absolutely. And Hannah, I guess we're now going to be looking back at the best films of the year. How's 2021 been film-wise for you?
Well, at the time of recording this, I haven't seen The Matrix. So, you know, we're doing this with a caveat that The Matrix might blow all our minds. I think it's been a strong year, you know. I think I say that every year. But I do think, considering the circumstances and having so much moving around and so much pushed back and festivals being in such a weird state, I think everyone's done really well. So everyone should pat themselves on the back. Filmmakers, critics, actors. Good job, everyone.
And also
audiences as well, yeah.
Yeah, those two.
Well done, anyone listening who's made it through this year. It's not been easy.
Yeah, very good point, Sophie. But before we put a bow on top of 2021, we do have one final new release week to discuss and one of the most conversation-starting films of the year to talk about, Titane. Let's start with a bit of plot synopsis for Titane. Newcomer Agathe Roussel plays Alexia, a young homicidal woman who, following an accident in her childhood, has an unusual bond with cars, a relationship that goes as far as consummation. When her murderous tendencies make her a fugitive, she disguises herself as a boy and forms a very ambivalent bond with the chief of a firefighting unit. So, we've been talking about this film, or other people have been talking about this film, almost for the entirety of this year. Of course, it was the cover film for the most recent issue of Little White Lies. So let's dial the clocks all the way back. Sophie, coming to Titane for the first time, off the back of Julia Ducournau's previous film, Raw, what were your expectations going in and how did they play out?
Yeah, so Raw really meant a great deal to me. And Raw has this great coherent central metaphor of a sexual awakening. You know, this character discovers a desire for flesh eating, and that sort of very much clearly means she's got an awakening for the pleasures of the flesh. And I think I was going into Titane expecting a similarly neat container. So it kind of took me aback the first time I saw it that it's a very different kind of playbook And I would also, I'd make the comparison to like Jordan Peele's 1-2 with Get Out and Us, whereas Get Out is such a tight, tight central allegory that anyone can see and appreciate, whereas Us is sort of more of a Rorschach test. And yeah, it, Titane as well, I was like, I don't even know what's going on here. And I was immediately struck stylistically by it. It's such a bold vision and all the soundtrack choices are incredible. So it blew me away on a style level, but it wasn't really until I watched it for a second time that I kind of got a read on it. And actually the second time I saw it, I was incredibly moved by what I saw as the love story element. There's so much else going on in it in terms of like bodily transformation and you know the making love with cars. But actually the thing that stood out to me was the relationship between Vincent Lindon and Agatha Russo. And like there's just this line at a certain point where he says, "I don't care who you are," and I just was like, this is a love story. Like I never saw a character who had such a desire to just love someone else, not even to be loved, but to give love, as Vincent Lindon's character, also named Vincent. So I don't feel like I've fully cracked it, like there's any one read that you could kind of put on it that would encapsulate all that it is, because there's so much going on. But I kind of think films like that, the most interesting, they inspire the best conversations, the most intriguing writing. It's just such a sort of elusive and slippery but compelling beast of a movie.
Hannah, were you compelled? Did you get this first time out? Of course, later on in the year, you'd eventually have an element of Titane tattooed onto you. But what was your immediate take on it?
Yeah. Well, I was lucky enough to see this at Cannes with Sophie and some of her other colleagues and friends. And it was definitely one of my most kind of anticipated titles at the festival. And very much, I think my reaction was similar to Sophie's in that I was kind of blown away on an aesthetic level at Cannes. It definitely was kind of a shock to the system in, I think the festival this year was of a pretty high standard. There were a lot of great films, but there was nothing kind of, I think, as audacious maybe as Titane. And it was this real, explosion. I think even from kind of the first scene, it's just, yeah, you basically open on a car wreck. The sun build up. But yeah, I don't want to say too much because also I'm aware that people listening to this might not have got the chance to see it yet. But I definitely, in that first time I watched it, I was taken by how sweet it was and how funny it is. It's a very funny film. I think that Julia's sense of humour sometimes gets lost because people are so keen to talk about how kind of brutal her work is or how, you know, shocking it is. But she's an incredibly funny filmmaker. There's a really hilarious scene where Vincent Lindon's character is a firefighter and he's teaching Agatha Russo's character how to do CPR, and he's doing it like to the tune of the Macarena, and it's just a really lovely scene. And that is kind of, I think, probably what stuck with me the most. I just think it's such a, for as much as everyone talks about the car stuff and the kind of body horror elements, I think it is a very human story about these two outsiders who desperately are looking for their kind of place in the world and haven't been able to find it, and they find each other, and it's kind of, you know, against all the odds, they find this thing they've been looking for. And I think it's a very, it might look like a story that's kind of, what, how would I say, like very out there and very kind of zany, but it's not at all, really. It's that classic Tales Old of Time thing of outsiders looking for each other, which I think is something that I always am drawn to within cinema. All my favourite films are outsider stories.
It's sometimes the curse of the festival premiere, isn't it, where a provocative film, and there are elements of Titane that are, it's, you know, continuing on from Raw, these specific, very visceral moments of shock or gore. And like with Raw, there were reports of walkouts, reports of fainting in the aisles. I don't know, Sophie or Hannah, if there were any within earshot of you when you saw the film. But then that then becomes part of the marketing strategy for the film later down the line. and whether there's much beyond that. And it sounds like you've both taken, you know, slightly different things from it. David, what was your response to Titan? And then we should probably talk a little bit about the provocative moments as well.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't, alas, at Cannes, but I was kind of monitoring from afar and seeing the reviews coming out. And it was very kind of fascinating to see this kind of these polarizing takes, where on one side you tended to have critics who were very taking the film very literally and picking up on things like, you know, plot holes and things like very, very kind of conventional things like plot holes and character motivations. And then you had this other contingent who were more like, you know, oh, it's a trip, man, you know, it's just, you've just got to like go with the flow and let it roll, you know, let it roll over you and sort of drink it in. And you know, that definitely was intriguing for me. And yeah, it's probably my favorite film of the year, actually. I probably would have picked it had we not been talking about it now. I had a sort of quite euphoric experience with it, like really one of those kind of, not, I think the last time it happened to me was seeing Claire Denis' High Life, actually, where I just kind of rolled out of the cinema and into the light and not kind of really knowing where I was. And I feel there's a lot of, you know, I think you could go into the minutiae of this film and pick apart all these kind of themes and ideas and proposals that it's making. But I kind of feel that, like, it's a film that sort of like set it within about the first sort of 5 or 6 minutes. It sort of sets out its own rule book for you to what to sort of take what it's giving. And I think you have to kind of, as long as you're kind of attuned to that, everything just makes sense, and you can kind of, it just kind of, you can just sort of meet with it. Even some of the kind of, you know, quite sort of weirder plot moments and motivations that may seem on the surface to be quite random, like when a character just suddenly has an outburst of violence. But yeah, I think the overwhelming thing is I think I love this kind of discordancy between and it's a similar thing with High Life, that you're being served up these extreme images that are maybe intended to be repellent and graphic and make you feel bad, but actually the actual overwhelming feeling you get from the film is something that is quite sort of euphoric and positive, and it's about, you know, it's about love, and it's about like the body as well, and the kind of the amazingness of the human body, I think, and what it and the human mind as well, what it can kind of take, the sort of battering that our bodies can take and still kind of pull through somehow. But yeah, I just think it's a real belter. And actually, like, going back to Raw, I wasn't a massive fan of Raw, to be honest, when I saw it the first time. And actually, like, reading stuff by, you know, excellent writers such as Sophie and Hannah, who make such a compelling case for it, I revisited it, and having seen Titan and really, really liked it a lot more, and, you know, saw the connectivity between the two films much more strongly. And I think that I think it does a similar thing of, like, it sets out its own rules and asks you to kind of follow them while you're watching, rather than just kind of taking each little thing as a sort of literal, you know, I'm watching a conventional movie that's doing conventional things. So, yeah.
It's interesting the way you describe that there, David, that when a film like this has that midnight type film confrontational, you know, description behind it, this film's going to make you faint, it's going to make you throw up in the aisles of the cinema, it feels like it's something that you that is going to, you know, be confrontational, whereas it sounds like you're describing, like, just take a trip, take down all inhibitions and go along with this, and maybe don't ask too many questions is the best way to approach. And I suppose, Sophie, to wrap up, because this film is still being marketed in some way as a body horror film in a David Cronenberg vein, but there's a whole huge chunk of this film that is not really related to so much to body horror. I suppose, what is the best way to think about this if you're going to do that horrible thing of pigeonholing it? But then how would you best recommend going into seeing this film, Sophie?
I think with an open mind. And in interviews, Julia Ducanal has, she sort of says she doesn't really relate to that term body horror for her work, even though she owns that she's very influenced by David Cronenberg. So I think just to see it as a human drama and to understand that the more visceral elements are not designed as provocations, they're part of something bigger. And yeah, to try and maybe like stand back and think, like take a view on it. It also is a bit like, it reminded me a bit of Under the Skin as well, because no one person took the same thing away from that film. And also High Life, like these are films that are mysterious subjects that tap into something very individual in each viewer. So I think tap into your individual visions, lads and ladies.
I would also say that it actually deals with an idea which is quite kind of uncinematic and just quite difficult, which is like the notion that people are impulsive and they do things that don't make sense. And like this film really kind of grabs that idea and asks that you kind of like believe in it and, you know, take it as something that, you know, like the motivations don't have to make sense, but we've, you know, people just do stuff like this. So,
well, there's so much writing out there about this film, a whole issue of Little White Lies as well to read up on. Sophie, I'll come to you first for the scores for Titan. This is in anticipation, enjoyment in retrospect. What would you give it?
Yes, I was hotly anticipating it. I can't overemphasize how much I got out of Roar, how many times I've watched Roar. I've written about Roar. I've interviewed the composer of Roar, Jim Williams, who also was the composer on Titan. So big old hefty 5 in anticipation. So to go by the first time I saw it, I think I was a little bit underwhelmed, but that's on me. That's just like the expectations that you bring to a film. So maybe to be accurate across both viewings, I'll give it a 4. And then in retrospect, it came alive again. So 5.
Hmm. Hannah, what's your scores?
Yeah, mine, I think, probably actually be the same as Sophie. I've kind of wrestled with what to score this one, because it is a difficult one. But definitely a 5 in anticipation. I also really love that Julia seemed very protective about the kind of information around this film. There wasn't a lot out there. It was very hard to get any read on what the film was actually about. I think before the Cannes premiere, all we had to go on was this very vague description and a few, like there was a kind of a trailer that was just like images, basically. So really appreciate that. It's quite rare as a film critic you go into something without knowing anything about it. So that was really nice. So definitely a 5 in anticipation. A 4 in enjoyment. Just because I think at first, yeah, I wasn't quite sure what to make of it. And also it was coming off the back of a really strong film festival. But I was so happy that it won the Palme d'Or. Really, it felt like a kind of moment, you know, a real statement by the jury. So I was really happy with that. And yeah, then a 5 in retrospect. I've had some great conversations about this film. I've read some really beautiful criticism and I think it's a really special piece of art and I really can't wait to see where Julia goes next.
And David, what are your scores?
I'd probably say anticipation was maybe like slightly lower than these guys, because I wasn't the massive Raw fan, but obviously when it won the Palm, I, you know, wanted to see it quite a lot, so probably a 3. And then just 5s I can't tell you like how rare it is, the feeling that the film gave me, actually, like just feeling completely like time stopping and then you kind of warped out into reality again. Yeah, it's a super, super rare thing. Like once every few years, a film like that comes along and just kind of, yeah, does something. It's just, as Sophie says, mysterious objects. They're the best type. Yeah, and I'm gonna, you know, got it all teed up for Christmas Day with my nan.
Well, listeners, that's Titan. Sounds like ones who approach with open mind, open arms, open hearts. It's a Rorschach test. We'd love to know what you see within it, if anything. Let us know at the usual channels at LW Lies on Twitter, Truth and Movies at tcolondon.com. But before we move on, we do have a clip with an interview with the actor, lead actor from Titan, Vincent Linden. Sophie, you spoke with Vincent at the London Film Festival. Could you tee this interview up for us? Who he is and what you spoke about?
Sure. One easy shorthand is to say he's France's answer to Tom Cruise. He's very famous there, less so here. But people who are fans of either Claire Denis' work or Stéphane Brisé, who's sort of a social realist director, will be familiar with him because he's appeared in Vendredi Soir and Bastards by Claire Denis and will be in her next film, Fire, which also has Juliette Binoche in it. I'd say the revelation of him is that he tends to play really like intense brooding characters, but I would say he has a deeply impish sensibility. And I think hopefully you'll get a sense of that in the interview where his answers are good and thoughtful, but, you know, be prepared to smile.
So here he is, Vincent Landon.
Normally being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
What does preparation look like for you for this character? Because it sounds like you wouldn't want to over-prepare.
I was obliged to, because you can
be a bit tricky.
With everything, but not with your body. At the time, Julia said to me, you have to be very, very muscled, and I want a man that we can imagine in 1 second that he's doing bodybuilding and he's shooting himself with a steroid to try to be younger, or even to try not to be so old as he is, and he wants to be in shape and try to lie to himself. And lie is, I'm not getting older and older, and I'm not going to die, because Adrien Alexia is someone who is afraid about the life and about living. And Vincent is somebody who is afraid about death and dying. So I was obliged to make this preparation. And it takes time, and like 2 years, because when you're very young, you can push your body very, very hard during 3 months, and then everything is changed. But when you are after 50, you have to go slow, and because not to break something and not to get hurt. So I was obliged to make sport every 2 days, one day on and one day off. And you have to change a lot of things. To lose weight is more difficult, to muscles is more difficult, to run is more difficult for the cardio. But I think I loved to do that because in a way, I'm not so far from the character. A lot of people say to me in France, wow, we never seen you like that. That's a big change for you. It's incredible. It's the first time I see you like that and send on screen. But which is quite amazing. It's I'm very close from the character. I think we share a lot of fear, a lot of things, and maybe reading the script, I saw between the lines a way of I saw that Julia will ask me to prepare my body, and maybe let's see, maybe in my mind, unconsciously, I said to myself, it's a way, by the way, for me, it's a good way to be in shape and to fight against death, against getting older, and I'm gonna jump on the occasion and profiter de l'occasion.
So to really profit from the opportunity.
To rebuild my body, maybe.
That was Vincent Landon speaking with Sophie Monks-Kaufman. You can see Vincent in Titane in cinemas now. But next, we're going to be talking about The Little White Lies' best films of the year. So yes, it is the end of December. And as is customary, we have to pick our favourite films of the year by law. The Little White Lies have picked top 30 films of the year, and they're up on lwlies.com now for you to look at your leisure. But for the purposes of this podcast, we have Hannah, David and Sophie. We're going to pick two favourites each from the top 30. Let's start. Hannah, I'll come to you first. What's your first pick of the 30 that you'd like to shout out on this podcast?
Yeah, so I can't tell you where in the list it comes, partly because I can't remember, but also because I want it to be a surprise. But the first one I have is The Last Duel by Ridley Scott, starring every famous man ever. No, sorry, starring Matt Damon, Ben Affleck, Adam Driver and Jodie Comer. And I was really pleasantly surprised by this film. I think when it was announced, I was very sceptical, you know, Matt Damon, Ben Affleck, revenge, rape revenge film doesn't really strike confidence into the heart of a woman. But I was really pleasantly surprised. I took myself off to see this when it came out, despite it having possibly the worst trailer of all time, and only having a very weird release where it was only in cinemas for about 3 weeks, and at very odd times. So it's quite a mission to actually get to see this in the cinema. But I was very glad I did. I think it's actually a really intelligent film that really kind of accurately depicts how exhausting it is to be a woman living in the patriarchy, whether it's in medieval France or contemporary England, contemporary world. And I was kind of surprised at the kind of delicacy and care with which Ridley, Matt, Ben, and Nicole Holofcener, yeah? Sorry, listeners, that's me trying nobly to pronounce her name correctly. But she co-wrote the screenplay with Ben and Matt, who kind of brought her on, begged her by all accounts to come and write the screenplay with them. And I think it makes it a better story. I think it makes it kind of more human. But the thing that kind of really surprised me is that it's actually a very funny film at times. Obviously, there's this really deeply traumatic event at the core, but I think it does a really great job of underpinning how, like, silly the kind of overwhelming machismo is within this court, where you have Ben Affleck playing this count who's kind of overseeing the local duchy, and Matt Damon and Adam Driver, the two knights, kind of vying for his favour. Jodie Comer plays Matt Damon's betrothed slash wife, and she accuses Adam Driver's character of raping her, so Jacques Legris. And you get this Rashomon style three versions of the same event taking place, but it's very clear to me that there is one account that is the true account. It's been fascinating watching the kind of discourse around this film, which I think has been absolutely terrible, because people don't seem intelligent enough to realise what the film is telling them. And the film is telling them that Jodie Comer's account is the honest account of what happened. Anyway, by the by, I think it is just a really engrossing action epic, with the titular Last Duel scene is incredible. It's like a real feat of fight choreography. I think that Jodie Comer kind of gives this performance for the ages. She's not someone I've really ever cared about that much. I'm not really a Killing Eve person, and I didn't really like her in Free Guy, so I was really pleasantly surprised here. I think that Adam Driver's kind of doing something different here from how we've seen him before, playing like quite a dislikable sort of weaselly little character in this. And then you've got Ben Affleck going like hell for leather, doing this absolutely ridiculous, very sort of like teenage boy in the body of a 40-year-old thing. And he has just this horrible bleach blonde bowl cut. And there's a scene where he has to pronounce a swear word that if I say it will get bleeped. And it's just like the most delicious line reading of the year. Just like the enunciation in his voice when he says it. Oh, it's like poetry. But yeah, I definitely think that people should kind of seek this out. It's on Disney Plus. And might maybe make up their own mind about it. Because I think the kind of online conversations about it have been quite exhausting and quite misrepresenting what the film is. So yeah, it would definitely be, it's not going to be for everyone, but it would be one of my underseen gems of the year for sure.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to watching that over the Christmas break, catching up with it, having not been able to make it out to any of those rare cinema screenings in that brief window it was in cinemas. Thank you for that, Hannah. That's a good strong recommendation for The Last Duel. David, I'll come to you next. What's your first pick of the bunch?
I think I'll go for Ryosuke Hamaguchi's Drive My Car, the 3-hour Japanese drama based on Haruki Murakami's short story. Kind of extrapolated from the short story, in that it kind of takes the text as a sort of starting point and drags it off in all these kind of strange directions. The basic plot is that you have a husband and wife who have this quite sort of strange relationship, and at the moment where she is going to reveal something about her kind of what he suspects to be her kind of infidelities, she drops dead. And he is sort of left, you know, to sort of ponder this mystery, and does so while directing a version of the Chekhov play Uncle Vanya.
It's happened to all of us.
It's a classic arc, really. I mean, it's, you know, who can't relate to that? I mean, you know, she's having dreams of lampreys. You know, it's all the classic stuff. But yeah, it's just this. I'll try and keep it pithy. He's just this incredible talent. I think in the sort of 90s, there was like loads and loads of Japanese films coming out in the UK. You had people like Kitano, Takeshi Miike making all these great films, and there was much more of a scene, and this feels like a kind of return of like Japanese auteur cinema on the world stage. I think he's made another film called Wheel of Fortune in Fantasy, which is not quite up there, but it has moments of absolute magnificence in it. And yeah, this film just deals with all of his abiding interests, such as like the sort of intersections between performance and life, and how, you know, drama and acting and pretending seeps into kind of reality and dreams. And yeah, I mean, the reason why it's called Drive My Car is because the sort of plot pivots towards this relationship he has with this young taciturn female chauffeur who drives him back and forth to the performance space for insurance reasons. And very, very, very slowly but surely they kind of strike up a relationship. And there's just all these kind of just jaw-dropping sequences in it where, you know, you have these very, like, you have, he takes very kind of simple ideas about and very conventional ideas about, you know, people rehearsing a play or people going for dinner or people talking in a car, and just does these weird, like, twists them in these quite strange ways that makes that kind of draws all these extra details and extra kind of points of emotional contact out of them. It's a film that I don't think it like completely works for me on a plot level. There are some like tiny little kind of niggles in there that I have, but like the overall sense of it is just so overwhelming and so impressive and just so ambitious that yeah, I can't help but love it really.
I think Drive My Car ties with Titan as for the film that we've spoken about the most on this podcast over the last year because of its various festival appearances on those updates and also on release. I'd say that's probably my film of the year. But Sophie, what's your first pick out of these best films of 2020?
Well, first of all, if you're into Drive My Car Entertain, then you guys are autophiles, I swear to God.
Yeah, we're gearheads, aren't we?
Mm. We should get on, what's that show that Jeremy Clarkson, I don't know. I want to say Total Gear, that shows how not a metal.
That's going to be our knockoff of Top Gear, is Total
Yeah, there
Gear.
We go, not Total Gear, Top Gear. Yes, so I was incredibly moved by Darius Marder's Sound of Metal, which, just to recap, I'm sure a lot of people have seen it, but maybe also a lot of people haven't. It starts out, you're on stage with Riz Ahmed, who's a metal drummer, as he just starts to lose his hearing. And this sets in motion great panic from his girlfriend, played by Olivia Cook, that this is going to cause him to backslide into addiction. We glean that he's a recovered addict. And then, so to sort of preempt this, he goes to a sort of very, very unusual kind of facility, which is like it's for deaf people, and it's like very holistic, and it's run by a former Vietnam vet, played with just the most beautiful humanity by Paul Ratchie. So it's a film that it's about this man who seems to have one problem, but it's actually another problem. It's like the hearing loss is a MacGuffin almost, because it's like, can he actually slow down and embrace his hand in life? And God, it's just so gripping, and there are so many sequences that are just very, very lovely. Like, I'm thinking about, because he's a character, Riz Ahmed's character, who Ruben, he doesn't really want to be there. He wants to at the retreat, he wants to fix his hearing and be on his way and continue his career as a metal drummer. And little by little, he starts to think maybe there are other things I could get out of being here. And when he starts to communicate with the deaf children and scenes like this, it's this kind of rare film where you, along with the character, your perception of what needs to happen increases, and it just feels really profound and beautiful. And I really recommend listening to friend of the podcast Al Horner has a podcast of his own called Script Apart, And he talks to Darius Marder. And what I found revelatory about the interview is sort of the years and years and years spent on realising this film. And that's something that maybe gets lost in the sort of churn of week in, week out releases. Is some films are real profound labours of love. I keep saying profound, but just it moved me so much. Like, what I favour in films is something I can kind of, I feel like it's vast enough that I could sort of find a place for myself in it, you know? And the film could maybe be my friend. It's like that. This film is a friend to me, and it has the most just perfect ending. It's like a quiet ending. It's not this great crescendo. And the quietness is kind of the point, because this is a man who, as the title of the film suggests, he's about noise and loudness. And then there's this very quiet ending, and it's just heart-stopping. I mean, no, I didn't die. It's heart-moving. Mm. Yeah.
I think that's such a lovely pick as well, because when we talk about films in end-of-year lists like this, they can become quite abstracted from the experience of watching them for the first time. And Sound of Metal, for many of us, would have been one of the first films we saw when cinemas reopened with a vengeance at the beginning of 2021. And it's a film that, with its sound design, with its performances, really was used cinema to its fullest to take you on that journey. Oh, that's a really good pick. Thank you, Sophie. Hannah, I'll
my pleasure.
Come back to you again, Hannah.
So my other pick, I'd like to also echo as well the picks of my fellow critics. I very much like all of these films. My other pick is a debut from Michael Sanowski. This kind of came out of nowhere, I think, this year. I don't think anyone really knew about it until it was released. And it's probably a film that would have been at festivals had it been a normal year. But it's called Pig. I believe it was discussed on the podcast, but I was not on that week. So maybe if you are interested in it, you can go back and listen to that episode. But yeah, so it's a Nicolas Cage film, and I think a lot of people kind of falsely assumed it would be another revenge romp with all guns blazing, but actually it's a very quiet, very soulful film about this man, Rob, who lives in the forest with his truffle pig, and they hunt for truffles together, and that's how they make their livelihood. They live this very simple existence, and then one day his pig is taken in the night by strangers, and Rob kind of has to go on this journey to find the pig, which is, I'm trying not to say too much, because I think it is one of those films that really benefits from not knowing what you're getting yourself into. I certainly didn't, and I was like broken by this film. I was devastated, like sobbing by about halfway through. It's a real emotional kind of gut punch of a film about this man who has really secluded himself from society, kind of closed himself off to hurt, or so he thinks, but then has to return to society and kind of realizes not only what he's kind of missed out on, but also why he kind of hid himself away in the first place. I think it really exposes a lot of the kind of hypocrisy maybe within the modern world, particularly within the culinary world. There's an amazing scene where Rob, who is a former chef, confronts another chef about his restaurant, and it's this real like takedown of kind of all the frou-frou bullshit that we get ourselves into to try and kind of mask over the important things. And this film really is just about taking a moment to appreciate the important things whilst we have them, because they don't last forever. And it's just a really beautifully pitched, really unique story, and everything about it is such a kind of thought has gone into it. I think that the cinematography is beautiful, the music is really kind of ethereal, and kind of has this like forest vibe to it. I've listened to it kind of independently of watching the film, and it makes you feel like you're kind of walking through the woods on your own. And I just think, yeah, it's kind of rare that you find a debut film that is so complete and such a well-executed piece of film. And it's really anchored by these incredible performances from Nicolas Cage and Alex Wolff, who I did speak to you for the podcast. It's all coming back to me now. Maybe I was on that podcast. Anyway, it's been a really long year, guys. But yeah, it's got these amazing performances that I think do kind of deserve more love than they're getting within the kind of crowded awards field. But even independent of what the awards say, it is just a really great film that I think is probably a great Christmas watch as well, just because it is all about family and keeping the people you love close to you, even after they've gone. So yeah, I really recommend it, and I've been lucky enough to kind of introduce people to it and see them having a similar reaction to me, which is a really special thing. So yeah,
Hannah, before we move on, can you just say one final word on Nicolas Cage in this film? Because I feel that we're speaking the week that the trailer for The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent comes out, in which Nicolas Cage is playing an exaggerated version of himself. So pendulum swinging almost back to turning himself into a comic caricature, whereas in this one this is almost peak dramatic Cage in a way.
Yeah, this is much more. I mean, there's definitely similarities between him in this and him in Mandy, but it's kind of, I think, closer to maybe something like maybe a cross between Leaving Las Vegas and Mandy, because he's very world weary in this film, but there's just like deep sadness that kind of, like, you see it come through in certain moments of kind of like confrontation. And it is just, it's such a joy to see him get this chance to take roles that I think people expect him to kind of go, you know, full on over the top, frothing at the mouth, but actually just be really thoughtful and considered and really make you care about this guy. And the character of Rob Feld doesn't feel like a caricature. He feels like this real human who lived this life and has kind of, you know, hid himself away from the world and is now slowly returning to it piece by piece. And it is just, yeah, I am always like rooting for the best for Cage. I always think, like, I love seeing him do his kind of crazy bug-eyed screaming at the camera type things, and I think he's someone who knows that about him. Like, you had to take this role in his next movie where he is just basically playing himself. He obviously knows that's kind of his persona. But then he comes and does things like Pig, and he really turns, you know, he proves he can still turn it on when he wants to. I think he's just someone who's very aware of the easy wins that he could have. And it's quite refreshing to see him still able to, you know, dial it back and take something very seriously and turn in a performance that I think is probably up there with the best of the year.
Mm. So yes, that's Pig. And listeners, you can go back through the archive and solve the mystery of whether Hannah was on that episode or not and let us know. David, what's the next pick of the best films of the year for you?
Well, I just want to do a shout out to I know this, the picks so far have been quite sort of serious, angular, like, you know, very, very sort of serious subject matter films. And I just want to get, and my other pick is of that ilk also. So I just wanted to give a very quick shout out to.
And so mine will be as well.
Yes, I'm anticipating that. So I wanted to give a quick shout out to a film that I only saw like last week, but it is definitely not a perfect film, but I had such a fun time with it, called Palm Springs. I don't know if you guys have seen it.
Yeah.
Oh, Hannah is grimacing.
Yeah, I've seen it.
I don't know.
Is Sophie not? No. Okay.
Well, I had to think for a moment because I kind of forgot I saw it.
because that came out in the States last year and finally came onto Prime Video in the UK this year.
Time.
Yeah. Groundhog Day.
Yeah. It's like Groundhog Day at a wedding. It was like, I think I liked it because it's like 85 minutes. And that in itself was a very refreshing aspect of the film, and I laughed a few times, which was, you know, It's something we all need in this this annus mirabilis or whatever you want to call it.
What's the barrel of laughs that you've picked for us next, David?
So I'm pivoting to rape revenge, obs, and going to my other pick is a film called Rose Plays Julie by Christine Molloy and Joe Lawler, two Irish filmmakers who have been they sort of began their career as working as kind of experimental theatre directors, really interested in kind of drawing in community and amateur actors and bringing like and they made this bunch of short films that are just kind of long single takes with lots of kind of local people in the community. They've kind of shifted. Yeah, the projects have got bigger and bigger. And this one, Rose Played Julie, is their most kind of ambitious. They're really massive fans of the Italian filmmaker Michelangelo Antonioni and this idea of alienation and identity. And that kind of comes into this story about a woman who is an orphan who, when she becomes of age, she decides to sort of find out about her true parentage and goes down this kind of rabbit hole of bureaucracy and some canny internet Googling to sort of find out where she came from and who she came from. And the answers, readers, will shock you. And it's just a very kind of intriguing and really sort of minutely calibrated revenge movie that kind of does things inside out and back to front. And it's quite an interesting kind of partner piece to something like Emerald Fennell's Promising Young Woman. And because in that it's sort of dealing with a lot more politically and culturally than just the kind of mechanics of this genre that is used for, traditionally for kind of pure excitement and titillation and the euphoria of being able to kind of exact your revenge on someone. Amazing lead performance by Anne Skelly, and Aidan Gillen does good bad guy. I know that these guys struggle to get their films out and get them funded, and I think if there was any justice in the world, they would be, people would be rolling stacks of 50s their way to make their dream projects. So hopefully in the coming years that will happen.
So that's Rose Plays Julie. I still need to catch up with that. I know we did cover that on the podcast a few months ago. I love their films, so that's on the to-do list over Christmas break. I can't wait to catch up with it. Sophie, you have the responsibility of rounding off this section with one more pick from the top 30. No pressure. What are you going to go with?
Well, interestingly, I've chosen a film. I mean, it's actually not for me to say whether what I'm saying is interesting. But I've chosen a film that there are many on this list that I prefer. I think, this is an interesting failure. It's also... on the note of revenge, it's a revenge film. On the note of heaviness, this is maybe the bleakest film of them all. And no surprise, it's from the king of bleakness, the fan of God's lonely men, Mr. Paul Schrader. The Card Counter, which is, it's a real journey into the dark underbelly of what man is capable of. And it is a revenge film starring Oscar Isaac as the titular Card Counter, and he's someone who has, when the film starts, he's reading Marcus Aurelius's Meditations in a military prison, and it doesn't take long to learn that the reason he's there is because he was at Abu Ghraib, and you do see scenes from Abu Ghraib filmed with a fisheye camera with heavy metal blasting over the top, and that is hard. I really love his previous film First Reformed, and like most other people in the cinephile world, I love Taxi Driver, It doesn't take a genius to see what Paul Schrader is obsessed with, to see what he's personally working out there. And that's sort of the level in which I'm interested in this. I kind of feel like, in a way, he's like our Lars von Trier, you know, he's sort of working out his own demons, but he never really works them out. So then he has to kind of start again and do the same thing. And he's just, man, he's so depressed. And he kind of finds like different ways into the same themes about how just like, you know, a small little dose of human contact will provide not redemption, but just like a little grace note of solace. And in this case, it's Oscar Isaac's William Tell. He ends up in a very sort of sweet situation with Tiffany Haddish's Lalinda, who runs a stable of gamblers. And Oscar Isaac's William Tell, he's like content after he comes out of jail. He's just really content to live a very, very small, monotonous life of driving around these identikit casinos, counting cards and winning small, and counting cards and winning small. So the stakes remain small. And what is the catalyst for him wanting to go for something bigger? It's a very taxi driver. He decides as someone he wants to try and help, and that's Ty Sheridan's character. And I won't kind of go into their relationship. So it's someone who's trying to claw back a little bit of good from the infinite drop of bleakness and inhumanity and the terrible things that man is capable of and the terrible things that America does that it never answers to. And like I say, I don't think it's one of the best. It's like wasn't in my top 10 of the year by any stretch, because I think whereas a film like First Reformed, it sucks you in and you're there throughout it. This, I kind of came and went with it. I don't feel like it's sort of an exercise in continuous tension. It's you know, it ebbs and flows. I'm interested in it also on the level of like the performance that Schrader gets out of Oscar Isaac, who is one of our most interesting and sexy actors, but he's not being sexy in this. He's being broken in this. And I kind of wanted to read out this from a Paul Schrader interview, except I've turned my phone off. But basically, he talks about Oscar Isaac giving, like directing Oscar Isaac to give this recessed performance. And he's like, you're going to be in every scene, you know? Like, if another actor comes and steals a scene from you, that's fine. You're going to outlast them all. And it is that. He's really retreated back into himself. And there's a sort of resignation to it, like a steel to it. And, yeah, it's really something to sort of just see someone doing something that is so small and almost non-existent. And, yeah, it sort of carries the best that the film has to offer. So, you know, this isn't for me an all-out glowing recommendation. Once again, Willem Dafoe has been cast for maximum nastiness. Like, you see also Guillermo del Toro's Nightmare Alley, which is out next year, which I really liked. You know, Willem Dafoe in the role of like abject ghoul. yeah, so again, this isn't like all-out like tub-thumping glowing recommendation, but it's like, and it's unlikely to convert anyone who's a little bit on the fence about Paul Schrader. But if you're interested in Oscar Isaac, and you have a sort of car crash interest in like how Paul Schrader's soul is doing, this is this is for you.
Well, I think that's a good thing to flag, Sophie, isn't it? That sometimes at the end of the year, it is just as good to salute those messy, complicated films that maybe we didn't all outright love, but there is something worthwhile in there. And absolutely, Card Counter, Oscar Isaac, although I think Hannah might question whether he's sexy or not in the performance, but Oscar Isaac is doing some terrific stuff in that film, really worth watching, particularly maybe in a double bill or close to what he's doing in June, to see the range that man has with and without beard
and clothes.
Can I also flag, because actually if we were doing TV shows, my hands down favorite film that I saw at the Venice Film Festival wasn't a film, it was Scenes from a Marriage. Which I believe is available for people to watch, and he's doing a whole lot in that, and he's so sexy in that.
Okay. can I make a TV recommendation as well, even though we're not doing TV?
We can do TV recs. What's yours?
Well, so on the subject of us being very serious on this, episode because we've chosen really serious films, I would like to recommend the delightful Only Murders in the Building, which is a, how would you describe it? Like a comedy drama about Steve Martin, Selena Gomez and Martin Short living in this apartment block in New York. It's a very, very lovely apartment block, and starting a true crime podcast together. It sounds ridiculous even saying it, and I was so sceptical, but it's been the highlight of my year. It is just absolutely delightful. You can watch it all now. I think it's on Disney Plus. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, it's only like 10 episodes of pure kind of delight. And there's a great cameo from Sting, like a recurring joke throughout the season. It's just a very, it's just so great to see Steve Martin and Martin Short, you know, two comedy legends at the top of their game. And Selena Gomez kind of like really keeping time with them. She's really great in it as well. And it is like pure, if you're looking for something a little bit lighter after all this doom and gloom we've been recommending, I would highly say treat yourself over Christmas and get stuck into it.
Can I have a quick TV recommendation as well?
Yeah, go ahead, David. Would you have a TV recommendation?
I want to recommend Rainbow Rangers on Netflix. It's a kid's film, my daughter's favourite show. It's about seven princesses and a unicorn called Floof, and they go out and they all have special powers and they save people from things.
I'm surprised, David, there has been a new series of Bluey this year and you didn't go for that. You've moved on already. Rainbow Rangers all the way. Sophie, since we're going on slightly more positive recommendations after all the doom and gloom of these picks, did you have something? I remember when we spoke maybe a year ago now, you mentioned Music and Lyrics was a film that you were returning to, something that you know, was a balm for your soul. Is there anything this year that's maybe more positive that you want to shout out?
I don't have any positive thoughts or recommendations, but what I want to fly the flag for is the catharsis of marinating in gloom, because, you know, it can make you feel seen in the deep, dark recesses of your soul, and it can make you feel slightly better because you're like, wow, this like fictional terrible thing hasn't yet happened to me, so maybe my life is good.
That is such a good note to end on. Listeners, there are 24 other films in the top 30 to look at, to argue over, to pick through. We'd love to hear what you make of them at the usual channels via email truthandmovies@tcolondon.com, or you can tweet us at LWLies. Sophie, Hannah, David, it's been a pleasure podcasting with you today on this bumper end of year episode. Listeners, we're off next week, but in our first new episode of the year, we're going to be talking about some big hitters. We have Licorice Pizza, the latest from Paul Thomas Anderson. We have Maggie Gyllenhaal's debut directorial feature, The Lost Daughter, starring Olivia Colman. And we also have a very special film club recorded live at the Prince Charles Cinema about Paul Thomas Anderson's Punch Drunk Love. Listeners, please subscribe wherever you pod, and if your podcast player of choice lets you leave reviews, we'd love you to leave one for us. Thank you for listening today and all throughout the year, and we will see you next time.
Toodaloo!
Truth and Movies is a Little Dot Studios production for Little White Lies. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Michael Leader, and my guests this week were Hannah Strong, David Jenkins, and Sophie Monks-Kaufman. The podcast is produced by Jake Cunningham and Harold McShiel and is edited by Steph Watts.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.